This is Joan Devlin. I'm in the studio with
J.D. Doyle.
And I'm here, too, in the shadows.
Jack Belinsky. And we're talking to James T. Sears, who is the author of Rebels, Ruby Fruit, and Rhinestones, Queering Space in the Stonewall South, which is the second volume in his absolutely fantastic gay history series on queer issues in the South. And this one, what made this one so much fun to read, is that it covers quite a bit of ground in Houston. Mm-hmm. So what made you decide to choose Houston, you know, in the mix?
Well, again, this period of time that this book covers is primarily from Stonewall to the first march on Washington in 1979. And during that period of time, during that 10-year period of time, Houston and Atlanta were really the two cities that had the most influence in the quote-unquote gay rights movement in the South. And in fact, as some of your readers, I'm sure, and listeners would recognize, by the end of the 70s, major national newspapers and magazines was calling Houston the San Francisco of the South.
And did you have much trouble tracking down Houston's history?
Yes and no. One of the things that, again, that Houston has that many cities do not have at the time I was doing this was an archives. Right now, in fact, Houston has two archives, which is really important because for too long, when we talk about history or we read history or we learn history in school, we don't learn about people's history. We learn about history of the great events or great people, which often are white and male, mm-hmm. and we certainly don't learn about our rainbow history. And the only way that we can tell our stories and tell our stories to the next generation is by maintaining and collecting those bits of memories of our communities. And that's in newsletters, those are in love poems, those are in photographs, those are in all different kinds of everyday life. And luckily, much of that was in Houston for this period of time that this book covers.
How had queer history changed in the era before and then after Stonewall?
The book that preceded this was called, or is called, Lonely Hunters. And that period of time covers basically from the early 50s through the late 60s. During that period of time in Houston, although there were, for example, a number of, quote, queer bars, etc., but oftentimes in places throughout the South, the space that you had if you were homosexual and living in the South in the 50s and 60s was a space that was really on the edges of the communities and of the cultures. So, for example, if you would go to a city, you know, any large city, or whether it be in Raleigh or in Tampa, and you were looking to meet other men, for example, then you would go to a bar. But how can you find a bar when there's not a Dameron's Guide? Well, one place you would go would be to the nicest hotel in that city, whether it's Thomas Jefferson Hotel in Raleigh. And at that hotel bar would likely be the place where you'd find some people who are homosexual. And again, that would just be by a wink and a nod. Mm-hmm. What happened during this period of time from the late, from the mid-60s into the 70s, you really have a number of activists who came out of the anti-war movement, the feminist movement, the hippie movements, etc., and they brought their activism to organize in gay issues. And so this book really talks about the emergence of communities in the South and communities in Houston and how space became queered in a lot of other places, from softball fields to MCC churches to radical fairy gatherings to leather motorcycle clubs like the Texas Wranglers, etc.
Is there a Southern gay sensibility?
That's almost redundant. I think there is a gay sensibility, and I think a lot of that is also Southern. One good example that I think is one aspect of queer communities is the drag culture, and part of that is clearly, you know, is really rooted in the South. If by Southern sensibility or Southern gay sensibility you mean being different than, let's say, Northern sensibility, absolutely. One of the problems that individuals had who were organizing in the South, who were doing it less effective, let's say, than people like Rita Wanstrom, I think really the grandmother of the gay rights movement, quote-unquote, here in Houston. One of the problems that some organizers had is that they did not have Southern sensibility. So they approached organizing in places like Richmond, Virginia, in the same way that one organized, for example, in Rochester, New York. Mm-hmm. Well, we know that how people get together as Southerners is sometimes very differently than how people get together in the North. So, for example, the whole notion of being social is much more important, I think, for Southerners than for other people outside the South. And so, when individuals and groups were organizing, for example, in Houston, one of the groups that was organizing were, you know, women's groups. And they, for example, I talk about the Milam House here, the National Organization of Women's Chapter, and also groups like the Lesbaradas. Those groups, like the Lesbaradas, they had softball teams, they had potlucks, they had lots of different newsletters, lots of activities that on the surface we say, oh, that's not political, that's not doing anything. But actually, that was quite political. But it was political because it brought together people.
It's a community.
It is a community. And when you bring together people and people who are queer, whether they're for a poetry reading or whether they're there for a motorcycle run or they're there for a drag pageant or they're there for an MCC congregation, then you are, in fact, creating communities. And that's what this book is about, is the emergence of different communities from Houston to Lexington, Kentucky, to Lubbock, Texas, to Norfolk, Virginia.
A community is not a city. A community is different parts of a city.
Yeah, and in fact, I talk about this a lot in the book, and I think Joan captures that also in the review that she that appeared in the Texas Triangle, and that is simply that when some people speak of the, quote, gay community in 1970s, the gay community of Houston or the gay community of Atlanta, you know, really they were misspeaking because they were really talking about perhaps what their vision as a small group of what this larger locality of people who were queer living in Atlanta was about. But in fact, those communities in Atlanta were groups of people who were grouped together based upon interest. So, for example, you had the Atlanta Lesbian Feminist Alliance there. You had, again, different groups like the Closet, the political groups publishing the Closet Door. And only occasionally would those groups intersect. A good example of the intersection here is in Houston, where you had the emergence of the Gay Political Caucus, and which eventually developed into the election of Kathy Whitmire as controller, and the unseating of Frank Mann. That was done through a series of alliances by people such as Pokey Anderson and many other people who cut across these different communities of differences. But sometimes when we talk about the gay community, we talk about the gay community in a sense of being monolithic. And also in terms of if the gay community should have an agenda. Well, whose agenda? So I think one of the lessons I hope that people learn from reading Rebels, Fruit and Rhinestones is that we are a rainbow community with lots of different interests and lots of different backgrounds and positions and philosophies. And what we need to do, the lessons of success and effectiveness, is when we honor those different voices, the voices of Lesbaradas, the voices of the Stuck softball teams, all these different kinds of voices, the voices of drag, etc. And the process of doing that, we become a stronger community, not a weaker community, per se.
Prior to Anita Bryant, was there much networking between the cities in the mm-hmm. South?
There was, as early as 1972, and I talk about this in the book, of course, there was a convention of, quote, gay Southern militants, and that was held in Athens, Georgia. 3 years later, or 4 years later, in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, was the first gathering of what was later to be called the Southeastern Gay and Lesbian Coalition. 75. And those groupings of those, of 3 or 4 days, brought together, you know, several hundred people who are organizing from all over the Southeast. And that was those kinds of conferences or conventions were incredibly important because it enabled people to communicate with one another across different localities. So not only people who were involved as lesbian feminists, for example, in Atlanta and Houston, but also people who were lesbian feminists and people who were radical fairies, etc. And so those kinds of organizational times were very important. But again, you mentioned Anita Bryant, prior to Anita Bryant, all these individuals, we're talking about, you know, several hundred people in the South by 75, 76 who were, quote, activists, that was a minuscule amount of people compared to those people, for example, who would go party at the old plantation, for example, or go discoing in the Glitter Gulch in Raleigh, or go to the be involved in one of the crews, gay crews in New Orleans and Mobile. Most of the quote queer community was outside of any of this activism. And Juanita Bryant and the referendum in Dade County did was to present an opportunity for those activists to in fact engage a larger group of people in organizing.
It mainstreamed the community.
It mainstreamed the community, and also it allowed if Stonewall was the match that started the modern gay liberation movement, then, in fact, Anita Bryant was really the wildfire that spread across the entire country, starting from the southeast, that engaged and enraged thousands of persons. And, in fact, after the defeat of the Dade County referendum in June of 1977, Anita Bryant was already scheduled for a variety of different Christian bookings where she would sing and et cetera. She first went to Norfolk. And when she went to Norfolk, there were hundreds of people outside the Scope Auditorium protesting. And inside, there were 100 people who were protesting. She immediately went from Norfolk to Houston, Texas, where there were hundreds and thousands of people who marched. And I talk about that march to the government offices and to protest her. And that was really the first time in all these different locations, wherever Anita Bryant went, she was met with a phalanx of different communities. Who were differences, who were all protesting the policies that she was promulgating. And so Anita Bryant and the Dade County Ordinance was really probably the singular most important organizing tool that activists had, and also was the very first time that we began to talk in this country, and particularly in the South, about homosexuality.
And even after she left the city, it left a structure, at least to build on, for that gay community.
Absolutely. And in some communities, for example, in New Orleans, there were community organizations that were developed because of that march, and then those community organizations continued. But if you can imagine, in small places like Tyler, Texas, for example, or Tupelo, Mississippi, where homosexuality was never discussed. All of a sudden now, you would be watching one of your three, and there were at that time generally only three TV stations, mm-hmm. and Walter Cronkite would come on and talk about homosexuals and Anita Bryant. You would turn on, if you did have a PBS station, McNeil Lehr Report, and there would be a debate between people like Anita Bryant and Bob Kunst. You would pick up your Montgomery newspaper, and the headlines would be, something about Anita Bryant, or there would be letters to the editor, or there would even be polls. What do Montgomery citizens think about homosexuals being allowed to teach, or homosexuals being fired if they were known to be gay? That was unheard of prior to that. And so Anita Bryant was really a critical moment for the community. And one last thing that I'll stop is, it also, I think, reflected the splintering of the quote gay community along these lines that I talk about, for example, lines of race and gender and class, because by and large, the Anita Bryant campaign was run in a way that really in many ways disempowered Latinos and Hispanics who were trying to organize in places like Hialeah, and also the depiction even of Anita Bryant herself. There's one famous picture of her in The Advocate, and she's painted as a cow, and you have an orange that's sort of up her butt. This notion of Anita Bryant as sort of the Antichrist really sort of missed the point, and almost became misogynistic, as opposed to understanding that Anita Bryant really was a reflection of forces of darkness, the forces of the radical right, which was really using Anita Bryant just as her husband Bob Green used Anita Bryant for other purposes.
The other thing is, what would you say was the most defining characteristic of our community back in the days between Stonewall and HIV?
Okay, and by our community, you mean the...
I mean the GLBT community overall. I mean, who were we then? What were our issues? What were our goals?
Well, again, as I think I sort of described a little bit, we had lots of different goals. And for many people who were even coming out during this period of time. Again, we're talking about a period, you know, a period of time where there truly was an era of sexual liberation. You know, the issues of drugs and drug enforcement was very different, you know, 30 years ago. And so for many people, again, who were gay and lesbian or bisexual, it meant simply an opportunity where queer space was more public. So, for example, if you would go to a bar or a club, you wouldn't, there would actually be signs, you know, for those clubs. You wouldn't have to go in the back door, for example. And that was liberating. You would go, you know, clubs, you know, towns from Lexington, Kentucky or from Louisville where people could disco all night and, or you could go to the plantation or the Bayou Landing and go to Sense Around, you know, and dance with hundreds and hundreds of people. That was a defining, very different kind of period of time than just 10 years earlier. And that is an element of the, quote, queer community that was part of the 70s. And beyond that, though, were many other individuals, who really still remained invisible. And I talk about in the book African Americans, for example, and some of them living in small towns, as well as those people, you know, where there would be no bars per se, but they would go to nip joints, for example, or also the underside of that, and that is in some bars like the old plantation. If you were a person of color, you'd often be asked for multiple IDs, or in places like Columbia, South Carolina, when there got to be too many women or too many people of color, all of a sudden, the dancers found that we went from disco to country and western because they wanted to clear out groups of people.
Mm-hmm. We are talking to James T. Sears. He is the author of Rebels, Ruby Fruit, and Rhinestones, Queering Space in the Stonewall South, which covers much of Houston's history among that of other cities. And I guess my next question for you is, I noticed that in some cases you picked up where Lonely Hunters left off. You actually talked to some people that you had been speaking with in Lonely Hunters and covered some of the cities. And then in the case of, for instance, Houston, you kind of picked up a whole new city. Mm-hmm. How do you decide, you know, which southern cities and which groups to kind of include?
Well, what I tried to do in Rebels, Ruby Fruit, and Rhinestones, because there was much more material that allowed me the luxury of selection, Lonely Hunters was a little bit more difficult because there was less material available, just like the next book I work on in the 30s and 40s, there's less material. So by the one way that I selected the cities and communities was trying to look for diversity. So that we simply did not just focus on Texas or focus on Virginia, for example. But the other is to look at what areas seem to have had an emergence of communities. And one of the, I think a person who reads or studies the book will come to a realization that really there were different periods of tides where different communities of different sizes began to emerge in a more openly gay or queer way during the 70s. So, for example, Atlanta, Georgia, in 1971 was the first state or first city to have a gay pride march, followed by Dallas in 72. Well, you know, there were no gay pride marches at all, you know, for the entire decade in any city in South Carolina or in Norfolk, Virginia, for example. That community really began to organize, not until about 1976 or 77. So, in selecting communities, what I tried to do is not only select those communities that were influential at a particular period of time, but also by selecting a variety of communities, making sure that there was diversity there that reflected the different kinds of ebbs and flow that takes place in any kinds of organizing.
How difficult was it for you to find people willing to participate in your effort?
Most people were very willing to participate, and the way I work basically is it's not just stick a microphone in someone's mouth and say, here are the five questions and thank you, ma'am, and move on to someone else. I like to develop relationships with people I talk to, and many of those people I've become very good friends. And in the process of doing that, that I think allows me to be able to get to know those individuals, to be able to portray those people as human beings, not simply as someone on like Leonard Maklovich on the cover of Time magazine. So you get a sense for who they are. So I think that's one aspect of it.
And what have they taught you as you've been going along?
I think one of the most important lessons I've learned is that individuals make a difference. And secondly, that activism takes many shades. All of us do not need to be activists marching down or marching on at Montrose and Westheimer. But all of us have an ethical and social responsibility to act in an ethical and socially responsible way. And for some individuals, that's writing. For some individuals, that's simply disclosing his or her sexual orientation to a family member or family members. All those little acts all add up, like drops in a bucket, and that bucket eventually overflows with water. And that's precisely what happened in the 1970s. Individuals made a difference. And some people, who looks at Rebels Reef and Rhinestone as well says, there's too many people I talk about, or I don't recognize any of those people. Well, that's because what little gay history we have is primarily history from the West Coast and East Coast. And it also is the same kind of history that we were taught in school. That is history of several important people. And although people like Elaine Noble and Leonard Maklovich and other individuals made a difference, they were just some of the individuals that were contributing to the communities. And so people, as you mentioned, like Rita Wonstrom or Polke Anderson, the women that organized Point Blank Times, or if we go to Atlanta, people like Vicki Gabriner and Lorraine Hutchins, or in Norfolk, people like J.D. and J.R. and Marge Clearwater. All these are individuals that run, into people's minds only if they don't appreciate that we're talking about individuals, each of whom made a decision that they were going to act. And those collective actions is what brought about the emergence of communities in the South.
The other thing I liked is that you talked about things like, things that are pretty much from the times, like trying to start an all-gay commune. Mm. Different the way our movement, as always.
Radical fairies.
Right. As always, we interacted with other timely activist movements. It wasn't just about, GLBT issues. Lesbians also worked toward, passage of the Equal Rights Amendment. Mm-hmm. You had a Back to Nature movement that gay people were a big part of. You had an anti-war movement that gay people were a big part of. Was that something you were kind of expecting when you started out? How close did the information you received mirror what your expectations were?
Well, again, I don't think I was had any expectation because, there's very little out there in terms of books and articles about Southern queer history. Again, what we're basically presented with is the histories outside the South. One of the things I was surprised about was that within a period of time of Stonewall, within about a year and year and a half, that there were the number of gay liberation fronts that existed in odd places like New Orleans, for example, which, those of us that are familiar with New Orleans gay history knows that it's anything but an activist organized community. It's, or places like Louisville, Lexington, as well as places like Houston in terms of organizing on campuses. Those groups that were organizing, cut across all different kinds of cities, college cities. And in fact, the only conference that the Gay Liberation Front ever had was actually held in Austin, Texas. But that was the first wave of activism. And what happened after about 72, 73, you then have a beginning of another group emerging of individuals who are a little bit more mainstream in their thinking and in their organization. And I think that group of people made it possible for these other communities to emerge. And so I guess that's what I was surprised by, was not only the amount of activism that existed on college campuses and outside of college campuses, but if you just think about, like, in Houston, Texas, 5 years before that, when you had a bar raids, and I talk about the bar raid of the Roaring Sixties, for example, there's one person, Rita Wonstrom, who said, we're not going to have this anymore. And she formed a group called the Tumblebugs, a group of women who, along with, Percy Foreman and Ray Hill and other people actually took, the city to court for that. Well, there were, within a decade, there were literally dozens Rita Wonstrom's, and I think that is the surprising part to me is how quickly we went from dozens of people to hundreds of people. And the book ends, starts in Stonewall and ends in the March in Washington. And in the chapter that talk about the March in Washington, many of the people that you read about in the book are in fact in Washington in that October chilly day. And there, even the parade itself, you know, where Texas, for example, had the largest delegation, largest set of marches, for anybody in the South. You had the Houston, marching band there. But each group represented in the march, represented our diversity. And so you had women and people of color leading the march. And then you had different groups, as I said, like the Radical Fairies, the RFD, the motorcycle, groups. All these groups were marching. And that to me is, really symbolic of our movement. And to the degree that, to the degree that we ever want to approach ourselves with having a gay agenda, then I think that what we do is we betray that diversity that one finds in the March on Washington 1979, because it's through diversity that we have strength.
Well, the other interesting thing is that we're so spoiled today with email and everything that flashes around the world very quickly. Back then, we didn't have that type of communication. I mean, and some of the things you talk about in your book is that these parallels that happen in these different cities that are very isolated. I mean, even the Advocate, when you finally got the Advocate, you know, and I'm talking about the 80s, and you're talking about the 60s and 70s, when, you know, that news didn't get around that quickly.
That's absolutely correct. But, you know, you did have many small newsletters, and also, you know, women and men, you know, communicated not generally by telephone, but oftentimes either by traveling, through these conferences, like I mentioned, as well as through letters. You had small publications like Nuntius, for example, in Houston. You had the emergence of Integrity, Houston, in the early 70s. When people started to engage in activities, they also then began to network with other individuals. And it's that network and sharing of information, although slower than what we'd expect today, which really was had a really profound influence. You mentioned the Advocate, and of course the Advocate was originally called the Los Angeles Advocate. It's a city paper. And one of the things you asked earlier, Joan, about what some things I was surprised about when I was doing researching the book. One of the things I'm really surprised about was the disproportionate number of women and men who were activists throughout the country who come from the South. And one example, the reason I thought about that, because you mentioned the Advocate, really the other main magazine at the time was a magazine called Gay, G-A-Y, out of New York. And that was edited by two Southerners, a Southerner from Hindman, Kentucky, Large Clark, and his lover, Jack Nichols. But if you look at the enormous emergence, for example, of lesbian writing, okay, publishing houses, Daughters, Inc., Daughters, Inc. was a major publishing. It published Ruby Fruit Jungle, also written by a Southerner. Daughters, Inc. was located in New England, but is actually founded by two women, one Park Bowman and the other June Arnold, one from Houston, one from South Carolina. Look at women's music, people like Mae Christian, just to name one individual. Many of these individuals who had gained national reputation, you know, come from the South. Leonard Maklovich is another example of someone. And so I think one of the lessons that we have to have as, learn hopefully as Southerners is that not only is it a myth of Stonewall that nothing happened before 1969 in organizing, including the South, which it did, but also that Southerners didn't matter. You know, we could have lost the war between the states and the gay rights movement would have been the same. It would not have been the same because Southerners both in the South and Southern expatriates outside the South really made the difference, and that's why I try to chronicle in this book.
From a different perspective, if you did these books on the Northeast or the West Coast, do you think you'd get the same lessons?
I think there would be some parallels. I think, for example, what was just mentioned in terms of the difficulties of communication, the multiplicity of communities. I think that would be the a commonality. I think there would be differences, and I think those differences are partly rooted upon culture. I do think that, particularly in, we're talking about the period of 1970s, that this is the emergence of the new Sunbelt South. This is the emergence of the sort of the Nixonian Republican agenda for the South. You know, the South was still a very different culture and region and community communities than, for example, what you found in the Northwest or the West Coast or New England. Most books that are written on history really do focus either on a city, like Chauncey's book in New York City, or on a community, for example, like a Fire Island. There's really nothing that's parallel to this with respect to focusing on regions.
When you hear about the Madison Society, that's New York, Chicago, you know.
But even the Mattachine Society, and the Mattachine Society was the first organization that really took off, that was formed in 1951 by leftist communist Harry Hay. There were chapters, there were Mattachine chapters in the South in the 60s, including Florida. There were people organizing in Jackson, Mississippi through Mattachine. People are organizing through Mattachine in Austin. There are also the counterpart to Mattachine Society in the 50s and 60s was something called The Ladder, which was a lesbian magazine organization, and they also had chapters. And there were Daughters of Bilitis chapters in southern cities like Dallas and New Orleans.
And they networked.
Yes, to a certain degree. I mean, because they got comments at a mailings, they got the magazine, The Ladder. They attended conferences, or some of them attended conferences.
What's the response been to the book so far?
I think it's, for me, it's a little bit too early to tell. I think that part of the response here is there's people are surprised that there is so much that was happening in the South. And I think, again, part of that surprise is because we have been, I think, misled to believe that nothing of any importance ever happens in the South. I think the other surprising part to me is when people begin to read these stories, that they actually find relevance to some of the issues that we're facing today. And let me give you one example. In the beginning of the 70s, we were talking about the Gay Liberation Front. And what was really important there was not, was really human sexual liberation. Many people were fighting for. By the end of the 70s, the agenda had changed. The agenda had changed to more legislative changes, including in Houston, for example, the Gay Political Caucus, in terms of the election of Kathy Whitmire as controller, and later on with the referendum that went down in defeat. This movement from being separate from society and saying that we are different and that what we ought to be talking about is sexual liberation, to we want a place at the table of society, is I think, a parallel set of concerns that you find again today. Those individuals who see themselves again as more assimilating into society, and those two people seeing themselves as more separating from society. So you have, for example, one individual who was a Stonewall veteran in 1979, I quote him, said, you know, when I marched and rioted in 1969 in New York City at Christopher Street, you know, I was not rioting, you know, so that we would have, you know, Olivia Cruz's and 10 leather bars. You know, I was rioting for other reasons, okay? And by the 70s, there was a commodification of homosexuality. And the commodification was very clear. I mean, for example, you had Gay Bob dolls. You had the Village People. That type of assimilation and the tension between assimilation and radical differences from the mainstream society is something I think that people need to be aware of, because that has been present in each generation that organizes on behalf of or for something called the queer communities.
Mm-hmm. And how can people get your book?
Copies, I believe, are available in different bookstores. I was just, for example, at Crossroads. There's another bookstore in town, among others. You know, local bookstores, Lobo. They're also available at the main, you know, the large corporate bookstores, Barnes & Noble, to name others. You can also get it online, for example, Amazon.com. I think it's on the top 25 list of the Amazon.com gay list. So those are several places.
Great. And again, the title of the book is Rebels, Ruby Fruit, and Rhinestones, Queering Space in the Stonewall South. It is by author James T. Sears. And you are listening to Lesbian and Gay Voices.